Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Our series, Writing Quebec, continues all this week as we survey fiction and poetry from La Belle Provence since 1945. Writing Quebec will conclude with the reading of Hubert Aquin's next episode, the winning title of this year's Canada Reads, that begins next Monday. But first, a reading from Jacques Poulain's 1984 novel, Volkswagen Blues. Jacques Poulain is one of Quebec's most distinguished authors. Of his 9 novels, many have been honored with literary awards from Quebec, Canada, and Europe. His novels are studied widely in both French and English Canada. Volkswagen Blues tells the story of Jack, a man in search of his brother. In a Volkswagen van, he travels from Montreal to Gaspé, then on down through the states to Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis, and finally to California. Early on, he picks up a hitchhiker, a young Métis woman who he nicknames La Grande Sauterelle, the Big Grasshopper.
They were driving along Highway 132. It was mid-afternoon. The May sun warmed the inside of the Volkswagen. The cat was lying in the glove compartment, asleep. The road followed the coastline of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. They scaled promontories and descended sharply to the tips of coves. They took turns at the wheel, intending to drive as far as Quebec, where the man lived, that day if possible. They had left several villages behind them, Cap des Rosiers, Rivière aux Renards, Lens-Avalot. Jack was driving. He didn't say much because the countryside was beautiful. But at each village, he couldn't help repeating how surprised he had been to see his brother Theo's address in the visitor's book. I mean, really? St. Louis, Missouri. And he added, it's not even a complete address. He didn't understand. St. Louis, Missouri. No, really, why that city rather than another? Why not New York? Why not Miami or Vancouver or even Los Angeles? He didn't even know exactly where St. Louis was. In fact, he knew nothing about the city aside from the names of a few of the sports teams, the Cardinals in baseball, the Blues in hockey. La Grande Sauterelle rummaged in the pocket behind the driver's seat. Amid an amazing assortment of road maps that had belonged to the previous owner of the van, she found a map of the United States. With a felt pen, she traced what appeared to be the most usual route between Gaspé and St. Louis. Look at that, she said. Does it suggest anything special? She folded the map in half and laid it on the steering wheel while the man was driving. And he could see that the route followed the St. Lawrence, passed through Quebec City and Montreal, made its way through the Great Lakes, then headed due south, going down the Mississippi to St. Louis. It reminds me of something, he said, but it's rather vague. He hesitated. Something you've seen in old Canadian history books, she insisted. That's it. A picture that showed the first French explorations in America. Was that? Yes, that's what I was thinking of. They arrived at Anse Pleureuse. In the village, Jack parked the Volks by the side of the road, and they got out to stretch their legs and give the cat a chance to do what he hadn't done since morning. They walked along the shore. They talked about Teal, and the man recalled some stories from the childhood he and his brother had spent in a large frame house by a river, not far from the American border. Then he touched on some of the exploits of the discoverers and explorers of the New World. Champlain, Étienne Brûlé, Jean Nicolet, Radisson, Louis Joliet, Père Marquette, Cavalier de la Salle, d'Iberville, and La Vérendrye. Abruptly, the girl's face became impassive and her expression grew sad and obstinate. They returned to the Volkswagen. The cat got back in the glove compartment. La Grande Sauterelle gave the impression that she had spent her whole life at the wheel of a Volkswagen van. To climb hills, she would get a good start, shift down just as the motor was beginning to strain, accelerate as she got to the top, and then start the descent in fourth, taking on speed until, on the approach to a curve, she pumped the brakes to reduce the speed of the motor and shifted down into third to harness the compression force. I really like the way you drive, said Jack. Where did you learn? Looking glum, the girl peered at the road without a word. A few minutes later, however, she replied that she had learned from her father. He was a trucker, she said. He drove trucks along the North Shore and at James Bay. When I was little, he'd sit me on his knee and let me drive. Once he was sick and I drove a 10-ton Mack from Baie-Comeau to Manicouagan. At first he watched and gave me advice, but then he lay down on the seat wrapped in a blanket and went to sleep. When he woke up, we were at the 5th Manicouagan Dam. And how old were you? 15. He whistled. She smiled briefly, but at once her face closed up again. Is something wrong? He asked. It's hard to explain, she said, but I'll try. I was born at La Romaine on the North Shore. My mother's a Montagnier. She's the woman you saw at the Gaspé Museum. And? When you talk about the discoverers and explorers of America, I've got nothing in common with the people who came looking for gold and spices and a passage to Asia. I'm on the side of the people who were robbed of their lands and of their way of life, and... She stopped to look at a freighter traveling down the river. And apparently the Indians came from Asia and reached America by means of an ice bridge that used to cover the Bering Strait. We came from the west and you came from the east. There's 7,000 kilometers between us. All at once she burst out laughing. Excuse me, she said. I was starting to take myself seriously. Anyway, I'm not a real Indian. My father's white. I'm a Mitzi. The girl laughed again, but her laughter was beginning to ring false. Then the man announced, I'm going to tell you a story. What story? She asked, wiping her eyes. The story of El Dorado. He cleared his throat a couple of times and began. On the high plateaus of the Andes in South America, 2,300 meters above sea level, in a region unknown to white men that was called Cundinamarca, or the land of the condor, a solemn ceremony was held every year. The chief of an Indian tribe would shed all his clothes, coat his body with a resinous substance, and roll it in powdered gold. When he stood up, the sun made his gilded body glow, and he would march at the head of his tribe to the shore of a lake ringed by mountains, Lake Guatavita. There he got into a dugout canoe that took him to the middle of the lake, where he dove into the water. All the members of the tribe, even those who had stayed behind on shore, marveled at the luminous gleam produced by the body of their chief, the gold-covered man, El Hombre Dorado, when he dove into the pure water of the lake. They talked about it among themselves, overcome with admiration, and word spread from tribe to tribe, and from region to region, farther and farther, that somewhere in America there existed a rich, mysterious land that was the kingdom of gold, El Dorado. And that's it. That's how the legend of El Dorado was born. It's a wonderful story, said the girl. Thank you, he said. Didn't you know it? No. I read it in Chapman's book, The Golden Dream. And he couldn't help adding, somewhat sadly, everything I know, or just about, I've learned from books. What do you do when you aren't looking for your brother? Asked La Grande Sauterelle. I'm a writer, said the man. What are you? A mechanic, she said. I studied automobile mechanics. Do you have a diploma? No. You? Me neither, he said, smiling. Despite their fatigue, they were happy to be in Quebec City. They had taken the ferry at Lévis. Leaning over the rail on the upper deck, they looked out at the lights of the Chateau Frontenac and Dufferin Terrace slowly coming toward them. Jack had a blanket around his shoulders. The girl, barefoot as usual, said she wasn't cold. When they were fairly near the North Shore, he pointed out the house where his apartment was. It was to the left of the chateau. The second house, he said. Can you see it? No, said the girl. I just see a big black space. That's the Parc des Gouverneurs, but a little further, to the left, there's a house that's lit up. Yes? That's the American consulate. Then there's a house with a light on the top floor. The girl drew near and rested her head on his shoulder to get a better look at the lighted spot he was pointing to. Oh, yes, I see it now. She asked, does that mean there's someone home? No, I leave the light on because... He gestured vaguely. But there's no one there, he said. The boat was approaching the wharf. They returned to the minibus, and after the gangplank had been lowered, they drove off the ferry and the old Vaux struggled up the Côte de la Montagne. They drove around the Place d'Armes and under the arches of the chateau, then found a parking spot at the end of the Rue Terrasse Dufferin, a stone's throw from the house where the man lived. Taking a few belongings and the cat, they climbed the five flights of stairs, careful not to make any noise, because it was 4:30 in the morning. The apartment had only three rooms, living room, kitchen, and bedroom. But the half-moon window in the living room, which had a window seat that could hold two people comfortably, offered a sweeping view of the river, the south shore, and even the bridge to the Ile d'Orléans. There's no box for the cat, said the man. It doesn't matter, said the girl, who was sitting on the broad window seat. We'll make do with newspapers for tonight. Do you want to go to bed right away? No. I'll sleep on the sofa. She gave no reply. She was looking outside, and her gaze was lost in the night. He came up to her. I'm going to make some hot chocolate. Would you like a cup? Oh, yes, she said. Tired? Not too. I'm waiting for daybreak, then I'll sleep for a while. In the kitchen, he heated milk and poured a small amount into a saucer for the cat, who was rubbing against his legs. When the chocolate was ready, he brought the two cups into the living room. He set one down beside the girl, then sat facing her at the other end of the window with his legs folded under him. She sipped it, then said, "It's very good. Thank you." She asked, "Tell me some more about Teal." He started to talk about his brother, and almost at once a wave of memory swept him back to the frame house by the river, not far from the American border. He began by describing the house. A stately square building, two stories high, with three cellars, an attic, and two sheds. On the second floor, on the south side, there was a large glassed-in porch where the sun warmed anyone who came there to read or daydream or trade secrets. The house, he said, was not right on the river, but about a kilometer away, and the most exciting way to travel that distance in winter was to slide across the frozen surface of a stream that ran near the house and flowed into the river. The stream had no name, and it was underground. It ran under the garden, under the neighbor's garage, under a vacant lot, under a tennis court, and under the main road. And it was a terrifying adventure to be flat on your stomach on a sled in the dark, icy tunnel where you would quickly gather speed, and if you deviated even slightly from the route Theo had laid out, risk smashing your head against a rock or being swallowed up by one of the eddies in the stream that had no name. Theo enjoyed risky games. One of his favorites consisted of being pulled on skis by the neighbor's snowmobile. A huge character, overflowing with energy, the neighbor was a doctor, and in winter, when the roads were closed by blizzards, he would use a snowmobile to call on patients who lived far from the village. "Dr. Noel's got out his snowmobile," people would say when they heard the dreadful racket the machine made as it crossed the village, sending up clouds of snow. The snowmobile, made of plywood, was shaped like a small automobile, a coupe, and was driven on two broad pairs of skis by an airplane propeller motor on the back. Whenever the doctor had some free time, Teo would don his downhill ski equipment and have himself pulled along the river, clinging to a long cable. He could hold on for hours, indifferent to cold and fatigue, intoxicated by the frantic speed of the snowmobile that kept backfiring and giving the impression that it might take off at any moment like an airplane. La Grande Sauterelle was looking out the window as she sipped her chocolate. From where she sat, with pillows wedged against her back, she could get a glimpse of the lights on the bridge to the Ile d'Orléans. Jack talked about the river a little more. Many of the memories that he shared with his brother were associated with that river. The memories had no precise age. He couldn't recall the exact year. But they were always associated with a season, and most often it was winter. He remembered, for instance, something from very long ago. Men were using a saw to cut blocks of ice out of the river, and those blocks of ice, stored under piles of sawdust, kept the food and household iceboxes cold during the summer. He also remembered that they would clear a circular skating rink on the river and that, to warm skaters and provide light for them at night, they would burn old tires in the middle of the circle. He remembered that he and his brother used to go into the forest on the other side of the river, where they would catch rabbits with brass wire snares. He remembered. The girl's head had dropped to her shoulder, and the man saw that she had fallen asleep. He hesitated briefly, then wakened her as gently as he could, and they turned in for the night. The girl to the big bed and he to the sofa. The man had trouble getting to sleep, but it had been that way for a long time. When he woke up in mid-afternoon, the girl wasn't there, or the cat. In the kitchen sink, he found the dishes she had used for breakfast, and they were the only traces of her in the apartment. She hadn't left a note to say where she'd gone or whether she'd be back. He looked out the window to see if she was walking along Dufferin Terrace, but she wasn't there. When he leaned out, he could see the old Vokes at the end of the street. Perhaps the girl's knapsack was still in the van, but he didn't really feel like going to look. He had a shower and something to eat, then started making a list of what he'd need for the journey to St. Louis. When he ran out of things to write down, he felt like going for a stroll, so he went out, leaving the door unlocked. The sky was gray, but it wasn't cold, and a fair number of people were walking in Old Quebec. The man crossed the park diagonally, then went along Rue Aldimont, and the slopes of the old city led him to the Librairie Garneau. Inside the bookstore, he studied the display of recently published novels and opened a few to read the first sentence. But nothing he read satisfied his requirements. The first sentence, he felt, should always be an invitation that no one could resist. A door opening onto a garden. The smile of a woman in a strange city. Then he went to the back of the store where the Québécois books were kept, and after checking that the clerks weren't watching, he looked for his own books on the shelves. He'd written five novels, two of which were, by and large, failures. Strangely, he found only the two novels he didn't like, and he opened one of them. The first sentence struck him as anything but an irresistible invitation. He replaced the book on its shelf and, before he left, bought the most recent road map of the United States. He went home by way of Rue des Jardins so he could buy milk, butter, and bread. Just as he was opening the door to his fifth-floor apartment, he heard the sound of dishes. He knocked before entering. La Grande Sauterelle was back. "Bonjour. I bought a few things at the grocery store," he said, as lightly as possible. "So did I," said the girl. "Oh, yes, what did you buy?" "Milk, butter, and bread," she said. "Me too," he laughed. He went to the kitchen to put away his purchases. Then he got down on his knees and petted the cat, who was drinking some milk. "Thanks for washing the dishes," he said. "You're welcome," said the girl. "And I'm glad you're back. Did you think I'd gone for good?" "I didn't know what had happened. I'd looked to see if you'd left a note, but you hadn't." "I couldn't," she said, because... She unfastened the long braid that fell to the middle of her back. Then she asked if he had a hairbrush. He went to get the brush from the medicine chest. "I never know ahead of time what I'm going to do," she said. He sat on the edge of the bed. The girl had her back to him, standing at the window, legs slightly parted, she was brushing her hair. She untangled it with delicate strokes, starting at the bottom, then she bent her head to the left and brushed with long, regular strokes, over and under. Then finally she shook her head until her long black hair enfolded her shoulders like a fur cape. When she turned around, she saw that the man was watching her wide-eyed and open-mouthed. "Anything wrong?" she asked. No, everything's fine," he said. He struggled to regain his self-control. "Was there a phone call for me?" he asked. "No," she said. "Are you expecting one?" He nodded. This girl was strange. Though he didn't know her very well, he felt very close to her, and he felt that she was very close to him. He couldn't lie to her. He told her that he was expecting a call from Sam Peckinpah. For action films, Sam Peckinpah was his favorite filmmaker. He had liked Straw Dogs very much. He had been captivated from the first images. The action had got faster and faster, and he had been carried away by the rhythm of the film up to the moment when the word "end" appeared in big letters on the screen. He had left the cinema breathless and as tired as if he'd run a 4-minute mile. Since that day, he had maintained the insane hope that old Peckinpah would call to tell him that he'd read his latest novel and wanted to make a film of it. Someday, the phone would ring, he'd pick it up, and at the other end, he'd hear Peckinpah's gruff, nasal voice. It was ridiculous and illogical for all sorts of reasons, the main one being that he didn't write action novels, and besides, he wasn't even a well-known author. But every time the telephone rang in a small fifth-floor apartment on the Rue Terrasse Dufferin, he told himself, in spite of everything, that maybe this, at last, was the phone call from Sam Peckinpah.
That was Carl Meurat, reading from Volkswagen Blues by Jacques Poulin, translated by Sheila Fishman. The English translation is published by Cormorant Books. Getting away from it all doesn't necessarily mean going on a road trip or even hopping on an airplane. Sometimes it's just a matter of using your imagination. Jacques Brault is an award-winning Montreal writer and critic. In his poem, With a Look That Came and Went, he escapes the noise and crowds of a city street by turning his mind to pastoral pleasures. It's read by Paula Siambre.
With a look that came and went like a rowboat on St. Catherine Street full of water one Saturday night in June, that split the opposing current of the crowd, the ghost of a thought rode him steady and beautiful, although invisible to the eyes of the pussycats bent on cheap adventures. But his look, his very own, his look, rough stones, ancient rocks from a mountain in painful labor, his furtive look, slipping sideways, hanging from his eyelids, his look fallen from high flight, brought back, hovering on the lookout, his look tracked in zigzag, a glimmer of tranquility. You would have said, you would have shouted that nothing ever again would make him despair of floating over the crowd, of dodging among the bawling neons and the laughing greasers. Then he would touch a shore, and the green frogs at night would sing softly in the shelter of the great filaments of darkness. It is thus we imagine peace, the lowliest citizen who scents in the streets the remembered air, the air from a lost country.
Jacques Brault's poem, With a Look That Came and Went, read by Paul Essiambre. That's all for this evening's program. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late-night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights.